This is merciful for me because they have me working 14 hours today. I'm going to go have some hot tea.
Generalizations. The first is that the tension between between women's work and women's role in the family was present at the beginning of industrialization in a way that it had not been in the colonial period. So that we take for granted today that there's tension between women's role in the family and women's work lives. Many of us experience it either through our mothers or in our own lives profoundly. And if you don't experience it yet, whether you're a man or a woman, you're going to experience it soon. Because it's still there. It's there in very difficult ways. Okay? And I will be talking a lot about that later on. But industrialization and what it did to the organization of family life really began that tension in ways that haven't been experienced before, because it took men's work out of the home and out of the family and pulled some women, increasingly more women, into wage labor as well, raising fears that women's work outside the home would alter her relationship with the family. Okay? And the notion that women were grounded in the family was already present in the colonial period, but in much more flexible ways and in much more handleable ways, since everybody's work was grounded in the family, it wasn't so surprising that women's work was. Okay? Second generalization, which I think I can make because I lived through it too, is that Americans have generally avoided desperately the implications of this for much of our history. And although occasionally when I lecture on maternalism, for example, and progressivism, we'll talk about the little foray into dealing with the problem that government made, or the culture made. But for the most part, I think avoidance has been the main stance of American culture up until the last 30 years. And then we've been struggling with it because we didn't lay any groundwork for dealing with it before. And that's a theme that I will be talking about in different ways from now until the end of the semester, because it affects the family so profoundly. And thirdly, the third generalization that I want to make is that the constraints of women's home responsibilities have typically and almost universally placed women at a disadvantage in the labor force. It's not that, it's their connection with the family, their link with home life, their responsibilities in the family that have continually made them not equal participants, and I'm not just saying that they couldn't get into the workforce, who would want to be in the workforce necessarily, but when they were forced to be in the workforce, they were always at a disadvantage because of the notion that women weren't really permanent workers, they weren't really serious workers, they didn't even need the money. They were just there, okay? And all of the reasons for that is because they were seen as non-workers, and we'll talk about that in a minute, and their main job was that of the family. So that we're faced with that structural problem of disadvantage, and for the last 30 years, we've been faced with it, and I say we because the disadvantage of women, most women are married and have children in this society. So that the disadvantage of women in the workplace is also a disadvantage of families. Women who work hard and earn less bring less home to their families. And so the economic changes that have brought more and more women into the workforce in the 20th century, especially middle-class women, who tried to follow the ideology of domesticity and could not in the last 30 years. These economic changes have been such that the need for women's wage earning has clashed with the inability of our society to deal with women, large numbers of women in the labor force. Okay, so we're in a bond. We have a crisis. Women will not majority of women will not go back to the home. Okay, and when this economic boom ends, I promise you that some of those women who are profoundly privileged now to still be able to stay at home and not have to go and work for wages, some of them are gonna have to go back into the workforce as well, or their daughters will. Okay, so as a society, we have to figure out how to cope with that and also raise healthy, emotionally stable, well-loved, and well-nurtured children, and have same parents. And that's a problem that we haven't solved. Okay. Now, let me start at the beginning, or at least at an arbitrary place that I'll call the beginning, women's work in the pre-industrial period, very quickly going over some of the things I talked about regarding the colonial period. Now, there was no, because culture in some ways was up for grabs and institutions were up for grabs and relatively flexible in the colonial period as British and European culture was transferred but then translated into the American context. There was no law that dictated that women would necessarily be disadvantaged and couldn't have opportunities of social mobility in the new world. But the two avenues to social mobility in the new world, one was land ownership and the other was apprenticeship, you know, learning a trade, learning a how to be a craftsperson. Both of those were at least legally and officially barred to women. It doesn't mean that women in some states weren't able to inherit land and hold on to it, especially in the South, where certain laws and during a certain period of openness did allow women to own land. But only as widows or as dowries, and the legal system brought wives under the coverture, the auspices of their husbands. And once women married, they pretty much lost all their legal rights, even their rights to their children in the colonial period. Those laws weren't changed until the middle of the 19th century. And in terms of apprenticeship, although there was a great deal of informal apprenticeship, shoemakers and carpenters and other craftsmen very often taught their wives and their daughters their trade. Officially, these women worked as part of the family economy and were not able, essentially, to be free actors and agents selling their own labor. So that in the division of labor in the colonies, the women did the bulk of the production in the family economy, which included making food, you know, churning raw materials into food, cloth, candles, soap making. They took care of the farm animals. They took care of the kitchen garden, while husbands and sons did the plowing, the planting, the harvesting, with women's participation when necessary. Men sometimes helped at spinning and weaving when the farm work was slow in the winter months. And women's work, as I've already said, was seen as essential to the family economy. It was valued on a lower scale than men's, but remember, we're dealing with a hierarchical society that believed in the great chain of being, and men were at the top. I mean, first came God, then came the king, and then came the heads of families, okay? Fathers being the representative of the king in governance of the family. That's why when children went bad in the colonial period, it was the father who was blamed, not the mother, because he was responsible for not only his wife's behavior, but everybody under him, okay? But the notion that women's work was important lived next to the notion that women's work was important, but of course less important than men's. So it shouldn't be too surprising that that unequal importance, although I want to emphasize the essentialness awareness of women's labor in the home in the colonial period, because that's something that gets lost in the 19th century in this translation to a new economic situation. So the notion that women's work is important but subordinate to men's explains part of what happens. You know, when merchant capitalism and industrialization comes along and takes men's work out of the home. Women's work is reduced in the home. The need for women's work is reduced in the home when that happens. Not all women's work. The wife is still working from morning, you know, so from dawn till dusk. She's still doing all those chores, but not as many of them as she needed to do before. She can buy cloth. She can purchase cloth now. She can purchase bread. She can purchase candles. She can even purchase certain kinds of foodstuffs. So that a lot of that original production, which happened in the family, is removed from the family, and we begin to get a money economy. Remember, surplus, people are producing for surplus. And so the reduction for the need for women's labor occurs among young, unmarried women in the home who form some of the early factory workers in the early stages of industrialization in New England. And I think it's important to note that the factory, there was an ideology of industrialization in the United States because it happened later than in England. And the many had witnessed the degradation of labor and the degradation of families as whole families were pushed off the land, profoundly impoverished, and pulled into the factories where the children of 5 and 6 years old were working alongside their mothers and fathers in the factories. The early ideology of industrialization here said, no, this is not going to happen here, okay? And in many respects, those early factories were seen as opportunities for poor families to make a living, to bring in poor widows and children, poor women, so that they could make a living. And there was a understanding, a local understanding, that these factory owners would take some responsibility for protecting workers from exploitation. But the idea of protection broke down as the transition from a mercantilist state, which took certain kinds of responsibilities for the members of this state or the citizens of this state, transitioned into the demands of free market capitalism, which basically let the market determine what happened to people. And so the effects of the transition to wage labor for women were very complicated. For younger daughters of New England farmers, it initially meant an ability to continue to commit to the family economy, to contribute to the family economy, by being exposed to factory work in a new kind of way. But the effects on these women who experienced this were mixed. Some of them were able to earn dowries and then marry middle or upwardly mobile young farm men on the make who were moving into the lower middle class by moving to cities, taking jobs in this new economy. Others put their brothers through school so that their brothers could experience the social mobility that they did not. And others were pushed down into the impoverished working class and had to stay in this new permanent working class. It's also true that some women probably experienced a measure of autonomy and freedom from family authority that they had not experienced before. So we're beginning to see a certain detachment of both adolescent boys and girls from the authority of family life as capitalism begins to pull both young men and young women into these new economic situations. wage work on all families, was the drawing of sharper lines between affluent women who could afford not to work for wages and who could keep their daughters at home, and those families who had to send their daughters into the factories and sometimes took piece work into their homes or occasionally even had to go into the factory themselves. So with industrialization comes the emergence of classes. And in the United States, it's primarily the middle class and the working class. And it's the middle class that is creating a new kind of culture to go along with this change in family structure, where women and mothers stay home with children and are given different kinds of tasks than the productive tasks of the subsistence family in the colonial period. And I've already talked, this is a review, but I want you to understand how it's very connected to women's work and to economic development. This is where the emergence of the ideology of domesticity occurs. The middle class essentially invented the ideology of domesticity to help them cope with some of the changes that were taking place in the economic realm. And this is an ideology which dictates that middle class women, ladies, respectable women, whatever you want to call them, should stay at home. And they should be doing housework for their families, childcare, and the whole notion of childcare expands. The whole notion of childhood expands in this period, and I will talk about the emergence of childhood as a life stage along with this family, this new family structure. And so that this new family ideal was held up as the proper family ideal for everybody. It also meant that women who could not live up to this family ideal were denigrated. They were seen as lazy, shiftless, Irish, which also meant drunken Catholics, to Protestants, we already talked about that, irresponsible mothers, etc., etc. Mothers who had to work were clearly inferior morally. Okay? Here's the beginning of that notion of if you're poor, there's something wrong with you. Okay? And it still exists in our society. We assume that people are poor because they're lazy. Okay? And mothers who had to go into the factory to work were simply degraded, inefficient, immoral. Okay? And you've read about this. I suggest that you go back and refer to this again in Christine Stanzl's article, Women, Children, and the Uses of the Streets, which contrasts these new notions of middle-class mothering with the experience of poor women who simply can't live up to the ideal. So the wives of respectable artisans, those on the top of the working class, attempted to imitate this life as well. And we see those artisans, the top echelons of the working class, managing for the most part to keep their wives at home. Now those wives may have helped a great deal in the work, and some of the daughters may have helped a great deal in the shops, in the shoemaking shops which were located in the home during this period for a while until the shoe factories came in the 1840s and 50s and 60s. And certainly by the end of the Civil War. But they managed to retain a certain amount of respectability. For free blacks, who didn't have the economic wherewithal for the most part, although there was a segment of the black middle class in the North who tried very hard to live up to this ideal, but for most free blacks, for immigrants, the Irish, and then immigrants who came in at the end of the century in the 1880s, for widows, for those who were pushed off their increasingly impoverished farms by agricultural capitalism, factory work became commonplace. And about 10% of women in this period up until the 1880s, all women, worked for wages outside the home. Now, I want to talk about something else which has carried over to our attitudes about women's work today. And that's what happened to married women's work in the home in a wage labor economy. The most significant fact, I think, that we need to be aware of in these changes is the denial, the gradual denial of the economic worth of housework. Housework, anything that falls under the rubric of housework, is still not factored into the American gross national product. In other words, it's not considered work, it's not considered productive labor, it is assumed that it doesn't do anything economically. And so recent historical studies have shown the way this process occurred with the emergence of industrialization, in which the gradual meaning of work and the definition of work changed from labor in the household performed by everybody to waged labor, labor in which wages, for which wages were paid outside the home. So that gradually the notion of women's work sort of gets erased. It's not paid labor in the home. And so it no longer is considered work. And this is so that you do not see anymore by the 1840s and 50s a recognition of either the middle class wife's economic role in the household or the working class wife's economic role in the household. We begin to see the development of elaborate cash economy in the early 19th century and all through the 19th century. The emphasis on growing competition among males for wages and for property, which enhances the importance of money, and money becomes the primary measure of social and economic work. So that all wives who stayed at home continue to produce an enormous amount. If it was only to produce the children who would then, or the sons who would take their place in the wage economy, to produce food, to dress their husbands, to feed their families, to take care of children, to do all the things necessary to allow the men in the family to function as workers, and everybody understood through folk mythology that if you didn't have a wife, you weren't fully a man. If you weren't a breadwinner who had a wife and child to show for it, you were not a man. You were not an adult man. And yet the idea of how the wife allowed the breadwinner to function in the work world was hidden and obscured. But we still see an extraordinary amount of work being performed both by middle class and working class women. Their labor at home was subsumed under child care and household management if you were middle class. And increasingly for middle class women, that meant consumption. It meant becoming the purchasing agents for this little family economy. But it also meant cooking, cleaning, baking, seeing to the family's provision of vegetables, whether or not you were growing it yourself or purchasing it at market. So the cultural invisibility of the value, the economic value of wives' work emerged in this period. And for working class women, it was extremely important. They didn't have the opportunity just to manage servants, consume, take care of children, and help to create this new life stage of middle class childhood. Working class women, as you learned from reading Christine Stansel's article, whether they were working in the factories or not, contributed up to $300 of the family economy through scavenging for food in cities, finding discarded clothing, making household implements, picking up fuel by going around, conversant of the transportation of coal, and picking up coal on the streets. How many of you saw, what's the name of that Irish movie? Angela's Ashes. Do you remember when the father left and the mother and the children were out there picking up coal from the streets? That is the classic. It was a classic working class family task, mother and children. Taking in certain kinds of piecework which was available to working class women, for immigrants later on, taking in boarders, all sorts of ways in which working class women contributed roughly $150 to $300 a year to a working class economy at a time when, if a family didn't make $800 a year, a family of four, it could not sustain itself. So that's almost a third, or maybe it is a third. Up to a third of, family income was provided by this hidden, non-waged labor that working class women performed. And of course, although middle class women performed their work in a more comfortable setting, they were also working hard, long hours, and performing essential labor in order for their men and their sons to participate as breadwinners in this economy. And this notion that if women are home, they don't work, has pervaded our assumptions about family life in the 20th century. Now, in 1988, when there was a lot of change going on, the divorce rate was going up in the 1970s and 80s, and the divorce law was still, sort of tied to notions of family life from the end of the 19th century. And a divorce lawyer who wound up representing a lot of housewives who had given 25 years of their life to, sort of sustaining families, raising children, and supporting husbands so that they could be breadwinners and then were basically thrown out on their ears and expected at the age of 40 to find some way of earning wages when their, main work had been facilitating the lives of others. This lawyer wound up representing a lot of these women, and he finally wrote a book called What is a Wife Worth? This was in 1988. At the time, he argued, and this also gives you a sense of how much inflation has happened from 1988 to the present. At the time, he argued that if you paid somebody an hourly wage to do what women did in the home, childcare, laundry, cleaning, transportation for children, meeting with teachers, childcare, all this stuff, that basically you would have to pay a wife roughly $35,000 a year if you farmed out the tasks that wives do for free. In 1994, I heard an interview with this very same lawyer on NPR, and the economy had changed, and so now, of course, this is an old statistic, but he updated the worth of these tasks, and in 1994, a wife would have needed to be paid $62,000 a year in order to pay for the tasks that women who stay at home perform for the family. And along with this hidden, sort of notion of the fact that this isn't work, our society assumes that women who stay at home with children are just playing cards and coffee clutching all day. So there's this sort of denigration. This notion that, when they have time, they just go out and shop till they drop, that kind of stuff. I mean, mean, the way in which our society both says that, you know, if you're a respectable and a caring mother, you have to stay home with your children, but then dumps on them for making that choice because they're lazy and they don't really do anything. I mean, it's really a schizophrenic attitude towards women. And I remember when I was, and this was before feminism, I was not, you know, in college when feminism had emerged. I was already out of college. I had just about finished graduate school. And we used to, at parties when you were introducing yourself to somebody, we used to ask questions like, well, what did your father do? What did your mother do? Did your mother work? And, you know, the answer, if you were middle class, was no, she didn't work. Even though my mother did not work for wages outside of home, I was lucky. She worked all the time. I mean, she was never. I never saw her sitting down. I never saw her. She was facilitating everybody in the world. I mean, that was what she did. She did a pretty good job of it. And, you know, at the end of the day, she was exhausted. Think about women in the workforce now who have to do both those things. Talk about exhaustion, for God's sake. But we'll get to that later on. Okay, so this is the moment in which housework and all the complicated things that women do to facilitate the functioning of the economy, you know, the gross national product, got hidden and denigrated. Okay, so to summarize, by the end of the Civil War, the patterns of women's work were set really up until the end of World War II. Working women were a relatively small proportion of workers because the ideal was if you were a real, true man, you could keep your wife at home. And so the even labor, you know, labor unions, when they demanded a family wage, we will come into discussing the meaning of the family wage again, you'll be reading about it. What that meant was to be paid enough to keep their wives at home, just like middle class men could keep their wives at home. That was the dominant notion of masculinity and of being a breadwinner. So the women who worked were the women who had to work. And between 10 to 15% of all women worked by 1880 for wages outside the home. And that number went up to about 20% by World War II, and then shot up to almost double that by the end of World War II. Okay, World War I, 20%. Almost double that by the end of World War II. When women did work outside the home, the only excuse that they were allowed to have, otherwise they were totally degraded and unrespectable, was that they were working for family needs, okay? The idea that you might enjoy work or that it might give you a certain amount of autonomy from your family and independence, not an excuse. Those kind of women were considered promiscuous and stepping out of bounds. So wage work for women became primarily for immigrant women, for poor women, for the desperately poor, widows, and there were a lot of them because there was no workman's compensation in this period of industrialization, and a lot of men were injured, or women whose husbands were injured and could no longer work. But in spite of these patterns, industrialization gradually continued because of the technology to expand the opportunities for women to work, and more women needed to work. There were a number of changes that took place that facilitated that. First, technology continued to streamline factory work in ways that allowed industrialists to hire cheap women's labor in different factories because of, you know, increasing technology which didn't require the kind of brute strength that men had. By the end of this century, employers loved being able to hire women because they can pay them half the wages of men. And the assumption that it was fine to pay women half the wages of men was based on this notion of proper womanhood. Even though people denigrated women unless they were working for their family, employers argued that women who worked were really under the protection of men and were just working for pin money. So you got it either way if you were working women. Woman. Employers paid you half the wages of men because the assumption was that you were only working for supplementary wages. And if you were in the workforce at all, you were suspect because you had to prove that you were helping a family. If you were a widow, God help you. Okay? Employers were delighted and recruited women wherever they could. And the other thing that happens with technology at the end of the 1880s is that a new workforce of pink-collar labor emerges with the emergence of typewriters, for example. Typewriters originally, clerks and secretaries was originally a male occupation. And the assumption was that most secretaries, male secretaries, would move into important positions of authority in these independent-owned businesses. But once these large corporations came along with these large numbers of employees, like you saw in the slide Tate presentation, and men were no longer self-employed and didn't have just one secretary who would inherit the business, people discovered that being a secretary and typing out letters was a dead-end job, which didn't have to include mobility up on the scale, and so it became a feminized occupation. And so a lot of women after 1880 began seeking out office work. And another popular occupation was department store work, saleswomen, working women who enjoyed, they were paid less than factory workers sometimes, but at least it wasn't dirty. You weren't quite as exposed to sexual harassment, although you were, but not quite as much in the same way. And so we begin to see technology moving more of young, unmarried working class women into other kinds of work, secretarial work, department store work, and factory work as well. You're going to be reading about, you'll be reading an article by Kathy Pice, which will talk about this new cultural world for women workers that emerges. A second stimulus on women going into the workforce at the end of the 19th century was the increasing number of affluent households of the middle class, which were able to relegate more and more domestic work to machinery, and therefore didn't need require these light chores from some daughters who were waiting at home to get married. And many of these young daughters began to continue to go through school till high school and then to college. And so we see a real change by the 1870s and 80s in which women's colleges are founded and drawing more and more young, unmarried, affluent women into college education. And what happened to some of those daughters, some very important things happened, and I'll speak about it again in another context, is once those women received equal college educations with some of the men, most men were not going to college then, they were going into business and making it. Part of the reason some of these big universities like the University of Michigan, which admitted women in 1870, were interested in having women is because they couldn't get enough men to sustain their operating costs. And so they began to draw on middle class women. But these women who came out of college with educations were sort of ruined or at least partially ruined for being able to go back into that Victorian family in which they were required to become, sort of home bodies and primarily child rearers. And many of these women began to seek employment for themselves that would satisfy some emotional needs to use their education. And in order to do that, they had to invent a whole range of new occupations. And so we see many of these college-educated women becoming factory inspectors, health inspectors in factories. They become social workers as the occupation of social work is stimulated by the horrible degradation that families, working class families, are experiencing in industrialization. And the old reform impulse, the women reformers who had begun to critique capitalist society in the 1830s and 40s and 50s, a new generation of women reformers, now college educated, begin to create the social welfare occupations that will address the absolute horrors of this new industrial state. So they become social workers. They become visiting nurses who go into the homes of the poor and try and help them with issues of health. Truant officers, jobs, taking jobs in bureaus of labor statistics in state and federal governments. Personnel officers, they begin entering graduate programs. They had already begun entering medical schools already by the 1850s, some women. And law school becomes increasingly more attractive too, so that by the 1920s, you get a significant minority, at least an equal minority of women, about 5%, studying law as there were women studying medicine. But it happened in medicine much earlier. You think there weren't any women doctors until 1960, right? You're wrong. There were the same percentage of women physicians in 1900 as there were in 1960. So women actually entered the medical profession in the 19th century. But anyway, these educated women began to manipulate the ideology of woman's sphere, the ideology that women were responsible for raising good children, preserving the morals of society, seeing to it that industrialization doesn't destroy the decency of Christian civilization. They began to take these notions very seriously, and as they did even earlier in their involvement in abolition and other kinds of reform movements, temperance, in the 1830s and 40s, at the end of the 19th century, they began to critique government, both state and the federal government, for not putting in place social welfare programs. And I will discuss that when I talk about maternalism and the invention of the social welfare state. But these educated women really helped to invent the social welfare state, at least the institutions that were eventually co-opted by the social welfare state in the early 20th century. Now, one of the things that many of these women reformers did, especially a large group of women who were studying sociology and political science at the University of Chicago and were involved in the founding of Hull House. How many of you have heard of Jane Addams and Hull House? Okay. Jane Addams was one of those college-educated women who didn't know what to do with her life. And she was so confused after getting a really good education and feeling on the one hand that she needed to commit to this sort of relatively idle life of an unmarried daughter until she got married and started her whole family. And she was not interested in marriage, not profoundly interested in men. She actually later in life became a lesbian. But the fact of the matter is that Jane Addams wanted desperately to use her education to improve society. And she had a breakdown after college in the 1880s because of this horrible choice that she felt. She had a lot of pressure from her family to come home. and she felt a lot of inner pressure to do something meaningful. And that's how she finally went to Chicago and established Hull House, which was one of the model settlement houses to deal with immigrant workers. And the University of Chicago, which had been founded in the early 1890s, had an extraordinary vibrant young faculty of W.I. Thomas, John Dewey, and a number of scholars who taught the first generation of women sociologists and psychologists. And in many respects, Hull House was a proving ground and a learning laboratory for those academics as they invented modern sociology and these new occupations that would eventually be part of the welfare state. Now, one of the most important issues on their agenda was protective legislation for women. And so that one of the things that women reformers, along with others who were supportive of bolstering labor's position vis-a-vis industry, the idea that women needed to be protected if they were going to work in factories, otherwise their bodies would be damaged for reproduction. And so protective legislation was a very, very complicated issue. It's very interesting that some of the most radical women who were interested in socialism did not want protective legislation specifically for women. They wanted protective legislation for all workers, men and women, because the understanding was that if women were protected, they would continue to be, only women were protected, they would continue to be disadvantaged in the workforce vis-a-vis men. But in the end, protective legislation was passed first by the states individually, and then eventually bolstered by the federal government. And the debate over protective legislation that historians have been carrying on ever since the Progressive period still goes on. And now the fact of the matter is that we believe that protective legislation did improve the work situation for a lot of women in the factories during this period. They were given breaks. Factory owners were forced to establish women's washrooms. They were barred from certain kinds of labor, night work, for example, which it was thought mothers shouldn't be doing. They should be home taking care of their children. In the end, what protective legislation accomplished was very, very complicated and mostly negative. It helped women at the immediate moment when they needed it, but the fact that men weren't protected also drove many women workers out of industries where employers ceased to hire women because it was too costly to institute the kinds of protections that were needed. Women who were barred from night work, for example, there was a large contingent of women, a large percentage of women working in the printing industry. And much of the printing industry went on at night because the bulk of the printing industry's work was newspapers. Women were essentially barred from the printing industry and lost a very, very lucrative and fairly decent paying niche in industry. Also in a number of leisure industries, bowling, for example, and amusement parks, where women were being hired at fairly decent wages, but which required night work. Women lost out there too and were unable to make gains because in many states those industries were protected also. This was particularly difficult for widows, single mothers who liked to work at night so that they could be around for their children during the day. So what we see happening in the long term with the institution of protective legislation for women is that it was based on the notion that women are weaker than men, that women need a certain kind of special handling within industry, And instead of equalizing the work experience for all men, and by the way, in Europe, the labor unions, for the most part, rejected protective legislation for women. They understood the implications, and they understood the ways in which it would reinforce the inequality of women in competition with men. And so the labor unions, which were much stronger in Europe during this period, I'm talking of France, Germany, England, Italy, for the most part, insisted on protective legislation for all. There's been a lot of debate among historians over whether entering the workforce was an emancipatory experience for women, or whether, in many respects, it reinforced their sense of second-class citizenship. And many, I think, historians want to argue that the experience of entering the labor force did offer a certain form of autonomy and agency to women who seemed to have more control over their lives. And certainly, Kathy Pice's article argues that women were agents and in control of their leisure time and understood how to negotiate things that they needed. On the other hand, I tend to side, and you guys have to make your own decision about this, I tend to side with the people who are skeptical, the historians who are skeptical about how profoundly emancipatory working class women's work experience was during this period and well into the 1950s. Women were paid less than men. Their second-class citizenship was constantly reinforced. It seems to me that the work culture, which dictated to young women that the best thing would be to get married and get out of the workforce, the way they were treated at work, often sexually harassed, all of these low wages, the impossibility sometimes of being able to make it on their own, having to live together because of the low wages, the idea that marriage was a cushion from abject poverty, and the low self-esteem, it seems to me, being placed in the lowest and dirtiest jobs, has to have had an effect on working class women. And I would argue that it's one of the reasons why I think working class women were relatively slow to respond to feminism when it began to articulate some of the needs of working women in the 1960s. Because working class women hated their jobs for the most part and derived most of their emotional satisfaction and meaning in their lives from family to the degree that they could. And so the notion that they should be out in the workforce, given what the experience of work was for women up until the 1970s, when equal legislation was put on the books nationally to reduce the discrimination of women in the workforce, both in terms of wages and other experiences. It seems to me that until you are treated decently on the job, working outside the home isn't always about independence. It can often be about being beaten down as well. Now I want to move to the period between World War I and the present and make some large generalizations about women's work during that period. The 1920s was a period in which the more affluent group of women who entered the workforce in these new pink-collar jobs continued to enter the workforce. And there was an expanding job market for clerical and secretarial work in the professions. And interestingly enough, in the 1920s, because of that, we begin to see in the women's magazines and some of the more progressive magazines a discussion for the first time about how women would balance work and family. And the notion of balancing work and family, how long should women work? Can women work after they get married? Can women work outside the home when their children are young? These were issues that were raised in the 1920s, and economists by the 1920s were also arguing that for a certain segment of the population, wage work for women was going to exist forever. So already by the 1920s, the situation, the pieces were in place to discuss what to do about the large numbers of women in the workforce, 20%, and how to balance family life and work responsibilities. But unfortunately, the Depression put an end to that public debate. And the reaction in the Depression against women working was swift and ironic. Married women were fired all over the place, from government jobs, from any other jobs. A lot of women had to hide the fact that they were married in order to keep working, even though many of them were the sole supporters of their family. Ironically, however, the numbers of women working during the Depression did not go down, because they worked at the dirtiest and low-paying jobs, which men wouldn't take. And so we, because of the way in which protective legislation helped segregate the work market, the labor force, men and women were not competing in the workforce. And so in the Depression, although women did lose their jobs, they didn't lose their jobs in the same ways that men did, because they were service jobs that were needed in spite of the breakdown of the economy. And this is when between a fourth and a fifth of the labor, male labor force was unemployed. Now, during World War II, and we'll be seeing a wonderful movie about this, Rosie the Riveter, the opposite happened. With large numbers of men leaving home, there was an extraordinary labor shortage, especially in the economy gearing up for war. And so government propaganda was produced to get as many women, including married women, into the workforce as possible. And you'll see some of this government propaganda when we show the movie Rosie the Riveter. But during World War II, as a result, women made some dramatic gains. And black women as well were able to move out of low-paying cleaning jobs into factory work, which was much better paid. Now, what's interesting about that period is, although the government profoundly committed for 5 years to getting women into the workforce, they did not commit to supporting women with childcare and other kinds of supports that would help women stay in the workforce. And so that a lot of women went into the workforce unsure of how to manage childcare. Many of them were absent. There was a very high absentee rate because there were no stores that were open after they came home from work to shop. And the ability to coordinate the needs of working women, something that happened in England, which, you know, stores were kept open until late at night, childcare was provided for, the understanding that if you're going to have married women with children in the workforce, you have to help them continue to take care of their families, that didn't go over here so well. And although there was some discussion, some factories did attach childcare centers, for the most part, there was very little response to the needs of working women once they were gotten into the workforce. Yeah.
I just wondered if there was like an increase in possibly older women who couldn't work in the factories. Did they go into childcare providing because of this shortage?
No, there was no coordination of need and knowledge. You really do need to do that, you know, in a systematic way. And either local government, state government, or the federal government has to, you know, get in and coordinate that. And there were no funds for thinking creatively about that at all. Here, there was in England, for example, where they desperately needed workers, and women workers filled that gap. Okay, because I want to talk about the exam, you guys can pass it out now. I'm going to stop here and finish up end of this lecture on women in work, in which I just deal with what happened after World War II in the present. I will finish that up just at the beginning of class on Tuesday before we see Rose and Fraser. But right now, I want you to read the exam, each question at least twice. Just to make sure that you've been attending lectures and know what day it is and what class this is. Okay? All right. You can do all of these. You should be able to do all of these. But you don't have to. You only have to do 5 out of 6. Okay? Now, let me remind you, these essays are a way of testing your knowledge, and I need to know that you've been doing the reading. So tell me, this is a chance to flout or flaunt, okay? Not flout, but flaunt. All the stuff you've been reading and everything you know, okay? And what I want, why I give this kind of exam, is because I really want you to sit down with all the stuff you've learned, your notes to the reading, your discussions, and I want you to figure out what it is you've learned in the past couple of weeks. And unless you are asked to bring this stuff together, think it through, you'll never know what you learned in this course, and I really want you to know what you learned in this course, okay? I want it to be active knowledge, okay? So, in your essays, and I'll get to the essays in a minute, every time you are thinking or referring to an article that you read and refer to an article. If somebody says X, you know, or if you got the idea from X, or you remember that an article says X, put it in parentheses, just the name of the author or the title of the article. I do not want any formal citations in this, none of that. We don't need that at all. Mention the movie. Use the movies as examples, okay? Now, I usually require also that you use handouts. Did I say that here? Okay, because we're still, mostly dealing with the period up until the present, you can't use your handouts yet. But do not throw away those handouts. I will require in the final that you make citations from some of those handouts. You're all thinking, what handout? I handed at least 2 articles from the New York Times out. Find them. If you don't have them, get them. Ask me. I have the extras, so does the GSI. Okay. All right, now, let me tell you who does well and who does not do well on this exam. The people who understand the questions, read the questions carefully, know what the key words and what the questions are asking of you do well. The people who invariably don't do well on this exam are people who really don't get the question, don't understand it, don't know what is being asked, okay? So you have lots of time. You have a full week to do this. You can email me, what do you mean about X in this question, okay? You can ask your GSI. Do not do badly on this test because you don't understand the question, okay? And believe me that the large number of people fall into that category. That's why I intend to read these questions with you. And I keep rephrasing questions because I am trying very hard to help you understand these questions. When I was an undergraduate, it was one sentence, not big long paragraphs here. Nobody cared whether I understood the question or not. And sometimes I wasn't sure that I did, okay? But you can do, all of you, every single one of you can get an A. That's what's good about these exams, is that, you know, it's just, if you do what you need to do, you can get an A on this exam. We don't grade on a curve. All right, question one. From the last decade of the 18th century, what is the 18th century? 1700s, okay. 1790s, all right? To the end of the 19th, the concept, okay, it's in black, of the ideal American family was transformed. Part of the reason for this was because the changes in the economic and social circumstances of Americans. Although this new model of family life exerted a profound influence on all Americans, only some social groups adopted it. Others did not. Write an essay that first discusses how and in what ways both the material conditions of family life, what am I talking about when I say material conditions of family life? Who's talking? Raise your hand. Yeah?
The goods produce and who produce them.
Okay, say it a little bit louder.
The goods produce and who produce them.
The goods produced, who produces them? Was there a lot of technology? Was it an agricultural family? Was it an industrial family? You know, who made the money? How did the money be made? Was there money? Because some of these groups, there wasn't any money, just a little hint, okay? All right, so the material conditions of lives are everything that has to do with the day-to-day living, eating, you know, dressing yourself, producing, et cetera, et cetera. So the larger economic atmosphere and everything else that goes into that, think expansively, okay? And I want you, write an essay that first discusses how and in what ways both the material conditions of family life and family ideology, we're back to concept, okay? And family ideology changed in the period under review. So I don't just want to hear about changing ideas about family life. I want to know what changed in the material conditions of family life, that under which family life was conducted. And I want you to understand how those two things, or I want you to understand and then be able to explain to us how those two things are constantly interacting. Then explain who tried to live by this ideal. Discuss why, after the ideal became dominant, some groups continued to live in alternative family systems. Discuss how this nonconformity with new social norms affected the attitudes of dominant classes towards these groups. Okay, you've got reading material and lecture material for all of this. Finally, and you don't for this means you've got to just speculate, give you a chance to think what, you know, counterfactual, all that, try to speculate how members of non-standard family groups felt about themselves, particularly in relation to the surrounding social order. Now, you have a little evidence of that. You certainly can infer you have some evidence. Think of one group that you have, one non-standard family group that you might be able to speculate how they felt about themselves. Name one.
Some groups of immigrants.
Okay, immigrants. Let's take the first immigrant group we discussed, the Irish, okay? We could probably, given what we've read and what I've talked about in terms of how the Irish were treated, how they, one way in which the Irish fought back, one way.
They played on Sunday.
Okay, they also drank on Sunday.
That's what I mean.
Okay, they established parochial schools. Biggie, a biggie, okay? All right, those are all the hints I'm giving you for that one. Now, question two. This is a hard question. People think it's the easiest question. It's usually not. It can be done very well, but you have to think. It can be argued that the manner in which a family obtains its living strongly determines how it is structured and how it functions. Looking at the period between the colonial settlement in North America, what date am I talking about? Colonial settlement of North America. You know, the classes are over for 2:28, 2:29, 30. One more minute. Colonial settlement.
1607.
Okay, 1607. Fine. Excellent. To roughly 1915. 1915 allows you to discuss immigrant groups, okay? Show how the economic structure of the societies in which different families live helped to shape family structure, roles, and relationships. What comes to mind in the colonial period? Two different economic structures that you could compare and contrast family life from. Okay, Native Americans and Puritans. Good. That's the only hint I'm going to give you for that question. But what I want you to think about, how did family economy affect relationships between husbands and wives, parents and children, family and society, work and play, even political and religious life and class status? You cannot answer all of these categories thoroughly. Okay? You can't. I know you can't, but you answer to the best of your ability and you can infer. Okay? There is evidence. Some of these categories you can only speculate. Okay? But you can take educated speculation. Okay. Do you think that the influence of economic factors has been decisive in shaping these other realms of family life? Do you think economics determines how family life functions? Is it the most important thing, or does it work in conjunction with other things? I'm asking you to take a stand here about how influential economic structure is. Yeah.
For the family relationships, do you want us to do each one a little bit or pick one or two and get more?
You mean each of the groups? Or?
Between the relationships, husband, wife, parent, children.
Yeah. You pick the ones that you can compare and contrast best, okay? The ones that you have the most information. Does that answer your question? Okay. Show how this may have worked in discussing what you have learned about the family economy of Native American families, African, so I've even given you the groups, African American families, immigrant families, Native white working class, and white middle class families during this period. Now that's a total giveaway because half of you would have been graded down a whole point for leaving out one of these categories. So I want you to think about all these things. I want you to all do well. How and in what ways did these families survive economically? And what similarities and differences among them can you know? And how did modes of economic survival affect these structures? Now, wait a second, okay? You could, one more minute, it may be worth it, okay? You do not have to organize your essays the way these questions are organized, okay? Organize your essays according to the rules of good writing. That will make a huge difference in your grade. One idea per paragraph. Illustrate those ideas with examples. Transition sentences from paragraph to paragraph. Think about how to organize this answer before you put pen to paper. Outline it if you can. Okay?